Well, I'm delighted to welcome you all to the LSE Anthropology Department and to introduce Professor David Graeber, this year's Malinowski Memorial Lecturer. Malinowski Memorial Lectures are offered to anthropologists at a relatively early stage in their careers, in contrast to most similar honours which go to colleagues at the pinnacle of their work or in recognition of a lifetime's achievement. Anthropology has been taught at the LSE since 1904, but the department owes its existence and its style to Malinowski, who arrived in 1910 and developed much of what became the distinctive style of British social anthropology. We are proud to remember each year his contribution. David Graeber is a particularly appropriate Malinowski lecturer. What's probably his best-known publication amongst anthropologists is Toward an Anthropological Theory of Value, The False Coin of Our Dreams, which was published in 2001. In this book, he offers an innovative reading of some of the key theorists of economic exchange and value, including Malinowski, as well as Mauss, Marx, and others. Of this book, Maurice Bloch has written in his characteristic style, "This is an extraordinary contribution to social science theory. What a contrast to the self-righteous sludge we usually have to endure. It is written with the verve, the clarity, and the humor of Swift. It is learned and not pedantic. It is an unpretentious yet totally committed attempt to understand the human condition, nothing less." End quote. The committed attempt to understand the human condition and to question arrogant and often Eurocentric certainties is at the heart of the continuing inspiration of anthropology as an intellectual project. As for so many of us, it was his interest in the range of human possibilities that first drew David Graeber to study anthropology. He started young. At the age of 11, he discovered that unlike Egyptian hieroglyphics, the glyphs of the Mesoamerican Maya had not yet been deciphered, and he set to work. Whether or not the history of the eventual decoding of Maya writing systems accords him a footnote, he decided to devote his life to this project and dropped out of high school to work on it without disturbance. He did indeed make some modest breakthroughs on his own account, working alone from home. On this basis, he returned to formal education and then went to the State University of New York at Purchase to study anthropology. The combination of radical parents and his study of anthropology led him inexorably to anarchist politics. As my colleague Brian Morris has argued, there is an elective affinity between anthropology and anarchism, and David has explored the potential of this linkage in a number of publications, including The New Anarchists, published in New Left Review, a collection on research militancy entitled Constituent Imagination, Militant Investigation and Collective Research, which he co-edited with Stephen Shukaitis, and Fragments of an Anarchist Anthropology, published in the LSE department in Prickly Paradigm Press in 2004. This latter text is also published in France and is currently being translated into Spanish, Italian, Portuguese, Greek, Turkish, Arabic, Japanese, and Korean. David's political activism was in particular inspired by the Direct Action Network of the 1990s, by Seattle and the anti-globalization movement. On the basis of a wealth of personal experience of political activism, he has compiled a lengthy text entitled Direct Action and Ethnography, which shows how theoretical intelligence can be poured into process rather than abstract theory, and how an ethnographic approach can be employed to explore people's implicit models in pursuit of self-criticism and democracy. In this work, he has been able to combine theory, practice, values, and realities in a way that most social scientists, including anthropologists, can only dream of. David did his PhD at Chicago, where Marshall Sahlins was his main supervisor. Once, Sahlins was asked, "How do you supervise a person like Graeber?" He responded in characteristic pithy style, "You don't." After a year teaching at Haverford College, David got a job at Yale, where he has been for the past 8 years. As many of you will be aware, his contract as associate professor at Yale was not renewed last year. This led to student protests, an article in the New York Times, and numerous interviews in the media. In the words of one of his colleagues there, "Yale has lost one of its most stimulating scholars by shooting itself in the foot." However, I'm glad to say that anthropology has not lost one of its most stimulating scholars. While he was, he believes, the first scholar to write a piece on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, David has also maintained what might be seen as a more conventional anthropological profile through his excellent research on Madagascar, which focuses especially on the relations between those of noble and of slave descent. Indiana will publish this work entitled Politics by Other Means, Magic and the Legacy of Slavery in Madagascar later this year. In his work on Madagascar, he has done a lot to correct our understanding of Malagasy ancestors as always beneficial and as a source of blessing and fertility. Inspired by the novels of Dostoevsky, he has written some astonishingly powerful descriptions of the oppressive nature of ancestors and the process by which the living violate them through rituals that break up their dry bones and erase their individual memories, and also how people do violence to each other without ever touching each other through symbolic and magical means. David Graeber's Malinowski Memorial Lecture is entitled, as you can see behind you, Beyond Power Knowledge, an exploration of the relation of power, ignorance, and stupidity. We look forward to it.
I'd like to, first of all, thank you very much for that introduction. First of all, say I'm especially honored to be giving the Malinowski lecture coming from Yale because, yes, I'm not sure if everyone knows this, but Malinowski spent the last few years of his life at the department at Yale. In fact, there's a giant portrait of him that hangs in the department, which always disturbed me a little because it looks uncannily like the Nazi villain in Raiders of the Lost Ark. So, of course, I was curious while I was there what sort of stories people and memories people had. And there's really two things I managed to elicit. One was that he was exceedingly fond of chasing fire trucks. Whenever there's a fire, he was always to be seen running behind it. And the other was that apparently he was a great hypochondriac because his office was completely full of medicine of every kind. Often said you could hardly move around because there was bottles everywhere. And we have a ceremony at Yale. He's buried there in New Haven, Connecticut. Not on the campus itself, but in a ceremony nearby. And students and faculty gather every year, I think on Halloween, to remember him. And there's a large headstone which says, you know, Bronislaw Malinowski, anthropologist, which always struck me as interesting because actually it's the first time I've ever seen a headstone of a person's occupation written on it. Normally, you know, it will tell you if mother or father of someone or if they were in the army, basically like giving life or giving death seems worthy of memorializing, but never one's occupation, and he's an exception in that regard. And at any rate, so people read from random passages from his work, and we pour a little liquor over the tomb. And actually, when I found out about his own proclivities, though, I actually was the first to offer some pharmaceuticals, since it seemed more appropriate. At any rate, let me begin the paper with a brief story about the nature of bureaucracy. Autobiographical. It's over the last year, my mother, who's 88, had a series of strokes. It soon became obvious that she would eventually be incapable of living at home without assistance. Since her insurance wouldn't cover home care, a series of social workers advised us to put her put in for Medicaid. Now, to qualify for Medicaid, one's total worth can only amount to $6,000. We arranged to transfer her savings, and this was, I suppose, technically a scam, although it's a peculiar sort of scam, because the government employs thousands of social workers whose main work seems to be simply to tell citizens how to do it. shortly thereafter, she had another more serious stroke and found herself in a nursing home undergoing long-term rehabilitation. When she emerged from there, it was obvious that she was going to need home care, definitely, but there was a problem. Her Social Security check was being deposited directly, and she was barely able to sign her name at that point. So unless I acquired power of attorney over her account and was thus able to pay her monthly rent bills for her, the money would immediately build up and put her over the line, disqualify her, even after I had filled out the enormous raft of Medicaid documents I needed to file to qualify her for pending status. So I went to her bank, I picked up the requisite power of attorney forms and brought them to the nursing home. The documents needed to be notarized. The nurse on the floor informed me there was an in-house notary, but I needed to make an appointment. She picked up the phone and put me through to some disembodied voice who then transferred me to the notary. The notary proceeded to inform me I first had to get authorization from the head of social work and hung up. So I got his name and room number, went down on the elevator, appeared at his office, only to discover he was, in fact, the disembodied voice on the phone. Head of social work picked up the phone, said, you know, Marjorie, that was me. You're driving this man crazy with this nonsense. You're driving me crazy, too, and proceeded to secure me an appointment for sometime the next week. So the next week, the notary appears. She accompanies me upstairs, made sure I'd filled out my side of the form, as it had been repeatedly emphasized to me, and then, in my mother's presence, proceeded to fill out her own. I was a little puzzled at the time that she didn't ask my mother to sign anything, but only me, but I figured she must know what she's doing. Next day, I took the form to the bank, where the woman at the desk took one look, asked why my mother hadn't signed the form, showed it to her manager, who told me to take it back and do it right. Okay, apparently the notary had, in fact, had no idea what she was doing. So I got new forms, filled out my side, made a new appointment. On the appointed day, the notary duly appeared, and after some awkward remarks about how difficult it is when each bank has its own completely different power of attorney form, we proceeded upstairs. I signed, my mother signed with some difficulty, and the next day I returned it to the bank. And this time there was another woman at the desk. She looked at the forms and immediately said, well, why did you sign the line where it says write and print on the line where it says sign? And I said, I did. Oh, I did. I just did exactly what the notary told me to do. And says, but it clearly says signature here. And I said, well, yeah, it does, doesn't it? I guess she must have told me wrong again. All the information is still there, I offered. It's just those two bits that are reversed. So is it really a problem? It's kind of pressing, and I'd really rather not have to wait to make another appointment. He said, well, normally we don't even accept these forms without all the signatories being here in person. I said, well, my mother had a stroke. She's bedridden. That's why I need the power of attorney forms in the first place. She said she'd check with a manager, and after 10 minutes she returned, saying the bank would not accept the forms in their present state. And in addition, even if they were filled out correctly, there was another form. I would need a letter from my mother's doctor certifying that she was mentally competent to sign such a thing. I pointed out no one had ever actually mentioned this previously, and the manager is sort of hanging a little bit away, heard this and said, what? Who gave you those forms and didn't tell you about the letter? So apparently the culprit was one of these nicer bank employees, so I changed the subject, noting that in the bank book it was printed quite clearly in trust for David Graeber. He, of course, replied that that would only matter if my mother was dead. As it happened, the whole problem soon became academic because my mother did indeed die a few weeks later. At the time, though, I found this experience extremely disconcerting. I mean, not just for obvious reasons. Having led an existence comparatively insulated from this sort of thing, I found myself continually asking my friends, is this what ordinary life for most people is really like? Most were inclined to suspect it was. I mean, obviously this notary was unusually incompetent. Still, I had to spend over a month, not long after, dealing with the consequences of some anonymous clerk in the New York Department of Motor Vehicles who decided my given name was Daeed. Not to mention the Verizon clerk who misspelled my surname Gruber. I'm still dealing with that. Bureaucracies, public and private, appear, for whatever historical reasons, to be organized in such a way as to guarantee that a significant proportion of actors will not be able to perform their tasks as expected. It also exemplifies what I've come to think of as the defining feature of a utopian form of practice, in that on discovering this, those maintaining the system invariably conclude that the problem is not with the system itself, but with the inadequacy of the human beings involved. As an intellectual, probably the most disturbing thing for me was how dealing with these forms somehow rendered me stupid, too. I mean, how could I not have noticed that I was printing my name on the line that said signature? I mean, said it pretty clearly. This despite the fact that I had been investing a great deal of mental and emotional energy in the whole affair. The problem, I think, was that most of this energy was going into a continual attempt to try to understand and influence whoever at the moment seemed to have some kind of bureaucratic power over me, when what was required was the correct interpretation of one or two Latin words and correct performance of some purely mechanical functions. Spending so much of my time worrying about how not to seem like I was rubbing the notary's face in her own incompetence or imagining what might make me seem sympathetic to various bank officials made me less inclined to notice when they told me to do something foolish. It was obviously a misplaced strategy, since insofar as anyone had the power to bend the rules, they were usually not the people I was actually talking to. Moreover, if I did encounter them, I was constantly being reminded that if I complained about anything, even a purely structural absurdity, the only possible result would be to get some junior functionary in trouble. As an anthropologist, probably the most curious thing for me was how little trace any of this tends to leave in the ethnographic literature. After all, we anthropologists have made something of a specialty out of dealing with the ritual surrounding birth, marriage, death, and similar rites of passage. We are particularly concerned with ritual gestures that are socially efficacious, where the mere act of saying or doing something makes it socially true. Yet, in most existing societies at this point, it's precisely paperwork, not other forms of ritual, that is socially efficacious in this way. My mother, for example, wished to be cremated without ceremony. My main memory of the funeral home, though, was of a plump, good-natured clerk who walked me through a 14-page document he had to file in order to obtain a death certificate, written in ballpoint on carbon paper so it came out in triplicate. I asked him, how many hours a day do you spend filling out forms like that? And he said, it's all I do, holding up a hand bandaged from some form of incipient carpal tunnel syndrome. Really sticks in my head. About those forms, though, my mother would not be legally, socially dead. So why, then, are there not vast ethnographic tomes about American or British rites of passage with long chapters about forms and paperwork? Well, the obvious answer is that paperwork is very boring. There really aren't that many interesting things one can say about it. Anthropologists are drawn to areas of density. The interpretive tools we have at our disposal are best suited to unpack complex webs of meaning or signification, intricate ritual symbolism, social dramas, poetic forms, kinship networks. What all these have in common, I think, is that they tend to be both infinitely rich and at the same time open-ended. If one's intention was to exhaust every meaning, motive, or association packed into a single Nkwala ritual, Balinese cockfight, a witchcraft accusation, or some family saga, for example, one could potentially go on forever. All the more so if one also wished to trace its relation with other elements in the larger social or symbolic fields they invariably open up. Forms, in contrast, are designed to be maximally simple and self-contained. There just isn't much there to interpret. Literature actually has the same problem with bureaucracy. At best, I mean, novels. At best, it can become the object of some kind of bleak Kafkaesque comedy. But even here, it's probably significant that Kafka has remained pretty much the only author to have made great literature of any sort out of bureaucracy. There's so little there that once you've done it, there's really not much for anyone else to add. Still, social theory abhors a vacuum. Nowhere is this more obvious than in the literature on bureaucracy itself. Insofar as ethnographies of bureaucracies exist, and I guess the paradigm here is probably Hertzfeld's The Social Production of Indifference, the bureaucracy as idiocy perspective tends to be represented at best as the naive folk model, whose existence any sophisticated cultural understanding of the phenomena must start by being able to explain. So it's data, it's not theory. This is not to say that such works necessarily deny that immersion in bureaucratic codes and regulations does, in fact, regularly cause people to act in ways that in any other context would be considered idiotic. Just about anyone is aware from personal experience that that is, in fact, the case. Yet, for purposes of cultural analysis, truth is rarely considered an adequate explanation. At best, one can expect a kind of yes, but, with the assumption that the but introduces everything that's really important. When we pass to the more rarefied domains of theory, even that yes, but often disappears. Consider here the hegemonic role in United States social theory of Max Weber in the 1950s and 60s, or of Michel Foucault ever since. Their popularity, no doubt, has had much to do with the ease with which each could be adopted as a kind of anti-Marx. Their theories put forth, usually in crudely simplified form, to argue that power is not simply or primarily a matter of the control of production, but rather of a pervasive, multifaceted, and unavoidable feature of any social life. I also think it's no coincidence, though, that these sometimes appear to be the only two intelligent people in human history who honestly believe that bureaucracies work. Think about it. Weber saw bureaucratic forms of organization as the very embodiment of rationality, so obviously superior to any alternative that they threaten to lock humanity in a joyless iron cage, bereft of spirit and charisma. Foucault was far more subversive, but he was subversive in a way that made bureaucratic power more effective, not less. Bodies, subjects, truth itself all became products of administrative discourses. Through concepts like governmentality and biopower, state bureaucracies in Foucault end up shaping the terms of human existence in ways far more intimate than anything Weber even imagined proposing. It's hard to avoid the conclusion that in either case, their popularity owes much to the fact that the American university system during this period, starting the 50s, had itself become increasingly an institution dedicated to producing functionaries for an imperial administrative apparatus on a global scale. The current ascendancy of Foucault seems to trace back to 60s radicals' rejection of Talcott Parsons' version of Weber for precisely this reason. The ultimate result, however, was a kind of division of labor, I think, with the optimistic side of Weber reinvented in even more crudely simplified form for the actual training of bureaucrats under the name of rational choice theory, while the pessimistic side was relegated to the Foucauldians. Foucault's ascendancy, in turn, was precisely within those fields of academic endeavor that both became the haven for former radicals, but that were themselves most completely divorced from any access to actual political power, or increasingly even to real social movements, which gave Foucault's emphasis on the power-knowledge nexus, the assertion that forms of knowledge are always also forms of social power, indeed the most important forms of social power, of particular appeal. No doubt any such historical argument is a bit caricaturish and unfair, but I think there's a profound truth here. It's not just that we're drawn to areas of density, where our skills at interpretation are best deployed. We also have an increasing tendency to identify what's interesting with what's important, to assume that places of density are also places of power. The power of bureaucracy shows just how much this is often not the case. This essay is not, however, primarily about bureaucracy, appearances notwithstanding, or even about the reasons for its neglect in anthropology and related disciplines. It's really about violence. What I'd like to argue is that situations created by violence, particularly structural violence, by which I mean forms of pervasive social inequality that are ultimately backed up by the threat of physical harm, invariably tend to create the kinds of willful blindness we normally associate with bureaucratic procedures. If I wanted to state the matter crudely, I guess I'd say it's not so much that bureaucratic procedures are inherently stupid in themselves, or even that they tend to produce behavior that they themselves define as stupid, but rather that they are invariably ways of managing social relations that are already stupid because they're founded on structural violence. I think this approach allows potential insights into matters that are, in fact, both interesting and important. For instance, the actual relationship between these forms of those forms of simplification typical of social theory and those typical of administrative procedures. Of course, we're not used to thinking of nursing homes or banks or even HMOs as violent institutions, except perhaps in the most abstract and metaphorical sense. But actually, I'm not being metaphorical. The violence I'm referring to here is not epistemic. It's quite concrete. All of these are institutions involved in the allocation of resources within a system of property rights, regulated and guaranteed by governments in a system that ultimately rests on the threat of force. And when people say force, it's just a euphemistic way to refer to violence, threats of physical damage. All of this is obvious enough. What's of ethnographic interest, I think, is how rarely citizens in industrial democracies actually think about this fact, or how instinctively we try to discount its importance. It's almost a knee-jerk reaction. This is what makes it possible, for example, for graduate students to be able to spend days, in the stacks of a university library, poring over theoretical tracts about the declining importance of coercion as a factor in modern life, without ever reflecting on the fact that had they insisted on their right to enter those stacks without showing a properly stamped and validated student ID, armed men would, in fact, have eventually been summoned to physically remove them. I mean, it's true. You just never... you know, if you just said, no, this is just too important, I don't need an ID, you know what's going to happen. It's just no one ever does. It's almost as if the more we allow aspects of our everyday existence to fall under the purview of bureaucratic regulations, the more everyone concerned colludes to downplay the fact, perfectly obvious to those actually running the system, incidentally, that all of it ultimately depends on the threat of violence. In many of the rural communities that anthropologists are most familiar with, where modern administrative techniques are explicitly seen as alien impositions, these connections are much easier to see. In the part of rural Madagascar, where I did my fieldwork, for example, that governments operate primarily by inspiring fear was seen as just obvious. At the same time, in the absence of any significant government interference in the minutiae of daily life, things like building codes, open container laws, the mandatory insurance on vehicles, and things like that, it became all the more apparent that the main business of government bureaucracy was the registration of taxable property. One curious result, that it was precisely the sort of information that I actually was able to get from Malagasy archives in the 19th and early 20th centuries for the community I was studying, basically exact figures on the size of each family, its holdings in land and cattle, in the earlier period also slaves, that I was least able to attain for the time I was there, simply because that was exactly what most people assumed that an outsider like me coming in from the capital would be likely to be asking about, and therefore what they were least inclined to tell him. Just people obviously didn't want me to poke around, so I didn't. What's more, one result of the colonial experience was that what might be called relations of command, basically any ongoing relationship in which one adult renders another an extension of his or her will, had become identified with slavery, and slavery with the essential nature of the state. There's a whole series of displacements here I can't really go into, but in the community I studied, such associations were most likely to come to the fore when people were talking about the great slaveholding families of the 19th century, whose children went on to become the core of the colonial era administration. Largely, it was always remarked, by dint of their devotion to education and their skill with paperwork. In other contexts, relations of command, particularly in bureaucratic contexts, were linguistically coded. They were firmly identified with French. Malagasy, in contrast, was seen as the language appropriate to deliberation, explanation, and to consensus decision-making. Minor functionaries, when they wished to impose arbitrary diktats, would almost invariably switch to French. I particularly remember one occasion when an official, who I actually had a lot of conversations with this guy in his office, who's a nice guy, always in Malagasy. He actually had no idea that I even knew French. And he was flustered one day to discover me dropping by at exactly the moment where everybody in the office had decided to pack up and go home early. So he immediately announced in French, "The office is closed. If you have any business, you must return tomorrow at 8 a.m. And I pretended confusion and claimed in Malagasy that I didn't understand what he was saying. He proved completely incapable of repeating the sentence in the vernacular. He couldn't say it in Malagasy. He just kept saying the same thing over and over again in French, even though he seemed to think, have no reason to believe I understood him. I later checked with friends, and they confirmed that, indeed, had he switched to Malagasy, he would have, at the very least, had to try to explain why the office had closed at such an unusual time. French is actually referred to in Malagasy as Niten Baikyu, the language of command. It was characteristic of contexts where explanations, deliberation, ultimately consent, was not really required, since they were ultimately premised on the threat of violence. In Madagascar, I think bureaucratic power was somewhat redeemed in most people's minds by its tie to education. Comparative analysis, I think, suggests that there is, in fact, a direct relation between the level of violence employed in a bureaucratic system and the level of absurdity it is seen to produce. Keith Breckinridge, for example, has documented at some length the regimes of what he calls power without knowledge, typical of colonial South Africa, where coercion and paperwork largely substituted for the need for understanding African subjects. The actual installation of apartheid, beginning in the 1950s, for example, was heralded by a new pass system that was designed to simplify earlier rules that obliged African workers to carry all sorts of documentation of labor contracts, substituting a single identity booklet marked with their names, locale, fingerprints, tax status and their officially prescribed rights to live and work in towns and cities, and nothing else. Government functionaries appreciated it for streamlining administration. Police really loved it for relieving them from the responsibility of having to actually talk to African workers. And the latter universally referred to it as the Dom Pass, or dumb as in stupid, the Dom Pass, for precisely that reason. There are traces of the link between coercion and absurdity even in the way we talk about bureaucracy in English. Note, for example, how so many of the colloquial terms that specifically refer to bureaucratic foolishness, like snafu or catch-22, at least in American slang, always derive from military slang. More generally, political scientists have long observed what they call a negative correlation, I believe David Apter put it, between coercion and information. That is, while relatively democratic regimes tend to be awash in too much information, the problem is trying to tell what information is actually in any way useful. The more authoritarian and repressive regime, the less reason people have to tell it anything, which is why such regimes are almost invariably forced to rely on spies, intelligence agencies, and secret police. Now, violence's capacity to allow arbitrary decisions and thus to avoid the kind of debate, clarification, and renegotiation typical of more egalitarian social relations is clearly what allows its victims to see procedures created on the basis of violence as stupid or unreasonable. One might say those relying on the fear of force are not obliged to engage in a lot of interpretive labor, and thus, generally speaking, they don't. But this is not an aspect of violence that has received much attention in the anthropological literature on the subject. The latter has tended instead to emphasize the ways that acts of violence are meaningful and communicative. Now, it seems to me this is an area where we're particularly prone to fall victim to the confusion of interpretive depth and social significance. That is, to assume that the most interesting aspect of violence is also the most important. I mean, I'm not saying that acts of violence are not, generally speaking, also acts of communication. Clearly they are. But this is true of any other form of human action as well. It strikes me that what is really important about violence is that it is perhaps the only form of human action that holds out even the possibility of having social effects without being communicative. To be more precise, violence may well be the only form of human action by which it is possible to have relatively predictable, that's important, effects on the actions of a person about whom you understand nothing. Pretty much any other way one might try to influence another's actions, one has to at least have some idea, like who they think they are, who they think you are, what they might want out of the situation, their aversions, proclivities, and so forth. If you hit them over the head hard enough, that all becomes kind of irrelevant. It's true that the effects one can have by disabling or killing someone are extremely limited, but they're real, and critically, they're predictable. Any alternative form of action cannot, without some sort of appeal to shared meanings or understandings, have any predictable effects at all. What's more, while attempts to influence others by the threat of violence do require some level of shared understanding, these can be pretty minimal. It's important to bear in mind that most human relations, particularly ongoing ones, whether between long-standing friends or long-standing enemies, are extremely complicated. They tend to be dense of experience and meaning. Maintaining them, therefore, requires a constant and often subtle work of interpretation, of endlessly imagining others' points of view. Threatening others with physical harm allows the possibility of cutting through all this. It makes possible relations of a far more schematic kind, like, you know, cross this line and I'll shoot you. This is, of course, why violence is so often the preferred weapon of the stupid. Indeed, one might say that it is one of the tragedies of human existence that this is the one form of stupidity to which it's most difficult to come up with an intelligent response. I do need to introduce one critical qualification here. If two parties engage in a contest of violence, say you have two generals commanding armies, people having a duel, something like that, they have very good reason to try to get inside each other's heads. That's obviously true. Imaginative identification in that context is pretty much required. It's really only when one side has an overwhelming advantage in their capacity to cause physical harm that they no longer need to do so. But this, I think, has very profound effects. Because it means that the most characteristic effect of violence, its ability to obviate the need for interpretive labor, becomes most salient when the violence itself is least visible. In fact, where acts of spectacular physical violence are least likely to occur. These are situations of what I've referred to just above as structural violence, on the assumption that systematic inequalities backed up by the threat of force can be treated as forms of violence in themselves. For this reason, situations of structural violence invariably produce extremely lopsided structures of imaginative identification. This is one of the real theoretical points I want to make. These effects are often most visible when the structures of inequality take the most deeply internalized forms. I was reminded of this actually when I was watching Nick at Night on TV. They have all these old 50s sitcoms, and there's this constant staple of 50s sitcoms about jokes about the impossibility of understanding women. The jokes, of course, are always told by men, right? And they always represent women's logic as fundamentally alien and incomprehensible. One never had the impression that the women in question had any trouble understanding the men, right? I think the reasons for this are obvious, that women had no choice but to understand the men, because this is the heyday of a certain image of the patriarchal family, which is what these shows were all about. And women with no access to their own income or resources had little choice but to spend a great deal of time and energy understanding what their menfolk thought was going on. Patriarchal families of the sort are, as generations of feminists have emphasized, most certainly forms of structural violence. Their norms are indeed sanctioned by threat of physical harm in endless subtle and not so subtle ways. And this kind of rhetoric about the mysteries of womankind appears to be a perennial feature of them. Generations of women novelists, Virginia Woolf comes most immediately to mind, have also documented the other side of such arrangements, the constant efforts women end up having to spend in managing, maintaining, and adjusting the egos of oblivious and self-important men, involving a continual work of imaginative identification, of what I've called interpretive labor. This carries on every level. Women are always expected to imagine what things look like from a male point of view. Men are almost never expected to reciprocate. In fact, so deeply internalized is this pattern of behavior that many men react to the suggestion that they might do so as if it were an act of violence in itself. A popular exercise among high school creative writing teachers in America, for example, is to ask students to imagine they have been transformed for one day into someone of the opposite sex and say, well, describe what that day would be like. Apparently, the results are uncannily uniform. The girls in class all write long and detailed essays that clearly show they have spent a great deal of time thinking about the subject, and half the boys refuse to write the essay entirely. It's true. It happens over and over. Those who do make it clear they have not the slightest conception what being a teenage girl might be like and deeply resent having to think about it. I think there are two critical elements here that, while linked, should probably be formally distinguished. The first is the process of imaginative identification as a form of knowledge. The fact that within relations of domination, it's generally the subordinates who are effectively relegated the work of understanding how the social relations in question actually work. Anyone who's ever worked in a restaurant kitchen, I guess you can tell this is autobiographical, for example, knows that if something goes terribly wrong and an angry boss appears to size things up, he is not very likely to carry out a detailed investigation or even to pay serious attention to all the workers who are all scrambling to explain their version of what happened. Much more likely, he'll just tell them all to shut up and arbitrarily impose a story that allows some instant judgment, like, you know, you're the new guy, you must have messed up, do that again and you're fired. It's those who don't have the power to hire and fire who are left with the work of figuring out what actually happened, what went wrong, so as to make sure it doesn't happen again. The same thing usually happens within ongoing relations. For example, everyone knows that servants tend to know a great deal about their employers' families, and employers almost never know much about the servants' families. This happens over and over again on every level. But there's a second element, and the second element is that of sympathetic identification. I think it's interesting that the first person to notice this was probably Adam Smith. In his theory of moral sentiments. He's also the first person to have observed the phenomena we now refer to as compassion fatigue. Human beings, he proposed, are normally inclined not only to imaginatively identify with their fellows, but as a result, they tend to spontaneously feel one another's joys and sorrows. It's the entire basis of his moral philosophy. But he noted the poor are so consistently miserable that otherwise sympathetic observers face a tacit choice between being entirely overwhelmed or simply blotting out the fact that they exist. The result is that while those on the bottom of the social ladder spend a great deal of time imagining the perspectives and therefore actually caring about those on top, it almost never happens the other way around. So whether one's dealing with masters and servants, men and women, employers and employees, rich and poor, structural inequality, what I've been calling structural violence, invariably creates highly lopsided structures of the imagination. Since I think Smith was right to observe that imagination does tend to bring with it sympathy, the result is that the victims of structural violence tend to care about its beneficiaries far more than those beneficiaries care about them. This might well be, after the violence itself, the single most powerful force preserving such relations. Now, all of this, I think, has some interesting theoretical implications. In contemporary industrial democracies, the legitimate administration of violence is turned over to professionals that we euphemistically refer to as law enforcement. Say euphemistically, particularly police officers, because as generations of police sociologists have pointed out, what police officers do has much less to do with enforcing criminal law than it does with the scientific application of physical force to aid in the resolution of administrative problems. Police are essentially bureaucrats with weapons. At the same time, they have significantly, over the past 50 years or so, become the almost obsessive objects of imaginative identification in popular culture. It's come to the point where it's not at all unusual for a citizen in a contemporary industrial democracy to spend several hours a day reading books, watching movies, or especially viewing TV shows that invite them to look at the world from a police officer's point of view and to vicariously participate in their imagined exploits. If nothing else, all of this throws an odd wrinkle in Max Weber's dire prophecies about the Iron Cage. As it turns out, faceless bureaucracies do seem inclined to throw up charismatic heroes of a sort, in the form of an endless assortment of mythic detectives, spies, police officers, all, significantly, figures whose job is to operate precisely where the bureaucratic structures for ordering information encounter or appeal to genuine physical violence. Even more striking, it seems to me, are the implications for the status of theory itself. Bureaucratic knowledge is about schematization. In practice, bureaucratic procedure invariably means ignoring all the subtleties of real social existence and reducing everything to preconceived mechanical or statistical formula. Whether it's a matter of forms, rules, statistics, or questionnaires, it's always a matter of simplification. Usually it's not so different than the boss who walks into the kitchen to make arbitrary snap decisions as to what went wrong. In either case, it's a matter of applying very simple pre-existing templates to complex and often ambiguous situations. The result often leaves those forced to deal with bureaucratic administrators with the impression that they are dealing with people who have, for some arbitrary reason, decided to put on a set of glasses that only allows them to see 2% of what's in front of them. Then you all have to pretend that that's all that's there. Admittedly, something very similar happens in social theory. An ethnographic description, even a very good one, captures at best 2% of what's happening in any particular newer feud or Balinese cockfight. A theoretical work, in turn, will normally focus on only a tiny part of that, plucking perhaps one or two strands out of an endlessly complex tissue of human circumstance, and using it as the basis on which to make generalizations, say, about the nature of social conflict or the nature of performance. Now, I'm certainly not trying to say there's anything wrong with this kind of theoretical reduction. I mean, probably doing it right now, right? It's not like it's a bad thing. Actually, I suspect some such process is necessary if one wishes to say something dramatically new about the world. Consider here the role of structural analysis, so famously endorsed by Edmund Leach in the first Malinowski Memorial Lecture almost half a century ago. Nowadays, structural analysis is considered definitively passé. Claude Lévi-Strauss's theoretical corpus is seen as vaguely ridiculous. Whenever I mention him to one of my students, they usually like throw up their eyes at the very idea that I should talk about him. It seems to me this is very unfortunate. The great merit of structural analysis is that it provides a well-nigh foolproof technique for doing what I think any good theory should do, simplifying and schematizing complex material in such a way as to be able to say something unexpected, which is actually how I came up with that point about Weber and the police. Let's see if this works. There you go. This is how I came up with it. So I prefer to see someone like Lévi-Strauss as a heroic figure, a man with the sheer intellectual courage to pursue his model as far as it would go, no matter how obviously absurd the results could sometimes be, or if you prefer, how much violence he had to do to reality. And, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with doing violence to reality as long as it's metaphorical. As long as one remains within the domain of theory, I would argue that simplification can actually be a form of intelligence. the problems arise when the violence is no longer metaphorical. So here, let me turn from imaginary cops to real cops. A former LAPD officer turned sociologist once observed that the overwhelming majority of citizens beaten by police turn out to be people who are not guilty of any crime. That cops don't beat up burglars, he observed. The reason, he explained, is simple. The one thing you can do, which is most guaranteed to cause a policeman to hit you, is to challenge their right to define the situation. So, you know, if what I'm saying is true, that's exactly what you'd expect, right? Because police truncheon is precisely the point where the state's bureaucratic imperative for imposing simple administrative schema and its monopoly of coercive force come together. So it only makes sense that bureaucratic violence should consist first and foremost of attacks on those who insist on alternative schemas of interpretation, which, you know, if you're innocent, you're much more likely to do. At the same time, if one accepts, obviously one is chary to give too much credence to the notion of intelligence as an intellectual concept, but if one is going to talk about, define it somehow, I guess the best attempt I've ever seen to define intelligence is that of Piaget, who defined mature intelligence as the ability to coordinate between multiple perspectives or possible perspectives, possible points of view. Well, if that's the case, one can see here precisely how bureaucratic power, at the moment it turns to violence, becomes literally a form of infantile stupidity. It's the very opposite of intelligence. If I had more time, I would suggest why I feel this approach could suggest new ways to look at old problems. From a Marxian perspective, for example, one might note that my notion of interpretive labor that keeps social life running smoothly implies a fundamental distinction between the domain of social production, that is, the production of persons and social relations, where the imaginative labor is relegated to those on the bottom of the social hierarchy, and the domain of commodity production, where the imaginative aspects of work are relegated to those on the top. You know, it works opposite in either case, but the one thing that they have in common is that structures of inequality produce lopsided structures of the imagination. I would also propose that what we're used to calling alienation is largely the subjective experience of living inside such lopsided and fractured structures of imagination, which I think has implications for any liberatory politics. But for present purposes, let me just end by drawing some attention to what I think some of the implications of this are for anthropology itself. And one is that many of the interpretive techniques that anthropologists employ have historically served as weapons of the weak far more often than they have as instruments of power. Renato Rizzaldo made a famous argument back in 1986 that when Evans Pritchard, annoyed that no one would speak to him, ended up gazing at the newer camp of Muad'Dit from the door of his tent. That was the title of the essay. When he did so, Rizzaldo argued, he rendered it something like a Foucauldian panopticon. The logic here seems to be that any knowledge gathered under unequal conditions ultimately serves a disciplinary function. Now, to me, I think that's ridiculous. The panopticon, people seem to forget this, was a prison. You know, it's got walls. Prisoners endured the gaze and internalized its dictates because if they tried to escape or resist, they would be beaten or killed. Absent the apparatus of coercion, if you're just observing everything, I mean, the observer is reduced to the equivalent of a neighborhood gossip, deprived even of the sanction of public opinion. I think underlying the analogy and all of these automatic panopticon analogies, which are so common, is an assumption that comprehensive knowledge of the sort that Evans Pritchard was seeking is an inherent part of any imperial project. But, you know, if you actually look at the historical record, the first thing you find out about empires is that empires have almost always had little or no interest in documenting ethnographic material at all. In fact, they tend to be interested in questions of law and administration. Bureaucracy kills this stuff. If you want information on exotic marriage customs or mortuary ritual, you almost invariably have to fall back on travelers' accounts, you know, Herodotus or Ibn Battuta or Zhang Qian in China. That is, descriptions of those lands which fell outside of the jurisdiction of whatever state the traveler belonged to. That's interesting to think about. Now, historical research reveals that the inhabitants of Muad'Dit were, in fact, largely former followers of a prophet named Gwek, who had been victims of RAF bombing and forced displacement the year before, the whole affair being occasioned by fairly typical bureaucratic foolishness, basic understandings about the nature of power in newer society, attempts to separate newer and Dinka populations that had, in fact, been entangled for generations. When Evans Pritchard was there, they were still subject to punitive raids from British authorities. Evans Pritchard was asked to go to New Orleans basically as a spy. He at first refused, and then he finally agreed, in his own words, because he felt sorry for them. He appears to have carefully avoided gathering the specific information the authorities really wanted him to gather, but at the same time doing his best to use his more general insights into the workings of newer society to discourage some of their more idiotic abuses, as he put it, to humanize the authorities. As an ethnographer, then, he ended up doing something very much like traditional women's work, keeping the system from disaster by tactful interventions meant to protect the oblivious and self-important men in charge from the consequences of their own blindness. Now, would it have been better to keep one's hands clean? Questions like that strike me as basically questions of personal conscience. I think we all have to decide these things for ourselves. I mean, I wouldn't, but I don't blame him. The question for me is whether our theoretical work is ultimately directed at undoing, dismantling some of the effects of these lopsided structures of imagination, or whether, as can so easily happen when our best ideas come to be backed up by bureaucratically administered violence, we end up reinforcing them.
Thank you very much, David, for a wonderful blend of humor and seriousness, of insight and provocation. The norm is that there are no questions from the floor at this stage in the proceedings, but if you're able to join us for a drink on the fifth floor of this building, you can no doubt provoke David further with some informal questioning. Thank you very much.